The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing, interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy because being human is the common denominator for us all. The project is supported by iZoon Technology Consulting, a global company specializing in cybersecurity, technological innovation for clients in defense and the private sector, and it's hosted on the Agenda Digitale website, an online news source reporting breaking news in tech and associated policy. Welcome to the Secure in Mind podcast. Today we have a special guest, and I am sitting in her office overlooking what is a very, very nice day on a holiday, I've been told, but on a select holiday for different people, depending on different religious beliefs in the European Union. Her name is Despina Spinel, and I think I nailed the pronunciation of that name because I was just told 30 seconds ago to correct it. So, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Okie dokie. So, look, I'm very much looking forward to this chat. I think there's a lot of things to go through. The European Union is certainly quite busy in terms of cyber these days and in terms of untangling some of the messiness of cyber and how that relates to the citizenry, how that relates to policy making, how that relates to military strategy, etc. Before we get into all that fun stuff, like we always do on this podcast, I should write a slogan for the podcast, but this would be the slogan if it did exist, and it possibly may. It's humanizing the human behind the policy, or knowing the human behind the policy. The emphasis is obviously to relate to the audience on a much more human level as opposed to a policy level, because policy level will just forget that. But if we like the person that we're talking to and we can relate to that person, then we'll listen to them a bit more, and maybe some of that policy and the necessities like use a VPN may sink in. So here's to hoping. So I'll turn it over to you, Despina. First things first, what brought you here? What's your background? Give us a bit of a rundown of what your aspirations were when you were in the education, going through school level, university, and how did you end up being in the position that you are now?
Thank you, Nick, and thank you for this opportunity. And if we're going to talk about my role in cybersecurity, I should have with me some 50 people who work with me in this area.
It always helps.
It's not me alone. We are a team of people here. Yep. Leading the policy in cybersecurity for the European Commission in the department of the Commission known with the acronym DigiConnect, because we're dealing with communications and network technology. So personally, I didn't study technology. I am a novice in this world, in a sense, but I have been involved for a while in a project that we call the Digital Single Market. So this is the effort of the European Commission to bring together a real digital single market. So to apply in the digital field what we know how to do best in Europe. So to bring together the 28 countries and have a common and united approach to things.
When you say market, what do you mean specifically by market?
This is the 28 countries that are the members of the European Union. So this is what the market is. And we have connected this market. This has been the core of the European Union's tradition. Mm-hmm. So we have products circulating freely, people circulating freely, services circulating freely.
Okay.
And for that to happen, we take a harmonized approach. So same rules and same approach applying everywhere.
Okay.
This way you have a level playing field and you don't have a fragmented approach of different rules applying everywhere.
Okay.
So this is what we have tried to do in cybersecurity. So how can I do that with my background? So I'm a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
I studied law, and in particular European law, and I entered the European Commission some 16 years ago.
Okay. But prior to that, you were working in private practice?
Yes, I was working for an American law firm for some years. I've been also in academia before that.
Yep.
And I always liked the idea of European public policy making.
Yeah.
And since I came to the European Commission, I managed to switch from corporate law business to more people-centric portfolio. So I worked in health, in food safety, in consumer policy.
Yeah.
And throughout my years in these areas, I had the opportunity, in a way, to manage crisis. Because when I was dealing, for instance, with food safety, we had this big avian influenza crisis in the European Union. Then when I was working on health, we had this new virus, the H1N1. And this is where I learned how to bring together inside the commission the people who know and propose the right actions, and then how to bring together the member states and the stakeholders who need to make that happen.
Okay.
So this is how I felt that we should work also in cybersecurity. I came here to work in this field 2 years ago with the mandate to make more concrete actions happen in the area of cybersecurity. We had a strategy in the European Union since 2013, which was about working together to build our resilience and our cooperation. We have for 15 years now a European agency for cybersecurity, but it did not have a permanent mandate and it had a very limited scope of work.
What was its mandate out of interest?
Well, it was more about awareness raising and creating more capacity in terms of knowledge. And the reason...
quite ineffectual or...
Well, it was, the agency has always been very good at that, but because it didn't have a permanent mandate and because we didn't have a concrete way of working together in the European Union, it was also a little bit lost.
Huh? It's fragmented. Was,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So we wanted to bring all that together. And we had also a very good basis because 3 years ago, we had for the first time an agreement to have a European cybersecurity law. This is something that people know as the NIS Directive, which created...
The famous NIS Directive.
Exactly. Yep. Famous, infamous.
Take your pick.
It was actually a tough call to go for this approach because, you know, directives, when you're a lawyer, you learn that directives are sometimes easier to agree on because they still allow a margin of maneuver for member states to regulate as they wish and to just fit these harmonizing parts in their national law. So it is a little bit easier than a regulation. But still, this was a directive that harmonized very important requirements. Because we have a market of 28 member states with goods circulating freely. But we had some countries that had very strong cybersecurity tradition. And skills, and others that had none, basically, where this was terra incognita, as we say in Latin. So it was unknown territory. And they were not equipped, and it was difficult for them to understand how to be equipped. So we introduced this first cybersecurity law, which required all member states to have a cybersecurity strategy. So to realize...
And sorry, that wasn't a directive, that was mandated. By that stage?
Well, this was in the directive, in the NIS.
Within the NIS.
But still, it was what we call full harmonization. So, meaning that everybody had to do the same. And whereas people may think that, okay, a strategy is just a paper, this was quite important because it meant a change of thinking. And it was important because if you have a connected market, this was our project, the Digital Single Market. So you have systems across 28 countries that are connected through the web, through the internet. So think of it very simply. Those that do not have the practices that are necessary to protect themselves become the weak links for everybody. So it was very important that everybody brings to par their strategic approach. And then this strategy was coupled with requirements like setting up emergency response teams. Believe it or not, in some countries this was not known. They were relying on help either from the private world or from other countries. And then we set up a network of working together at two levels, at policy level. So we set up something that's called the cooperation group, and it is a group of member state specialists, of authorities that meet very regularly and discuss how do we deal with all the problems, be that threats, be that common incidents, or even policy issues, and I will come to that later. And then we set up a network of the CERTs, the emergency response teams, who start talking to each other whenever there's an incident. For instance, this was activated when we had the NotPetya and when we had WannaCry. And instead of having four or five member states who would pick up the phone and start talking to each other so that they at least prevent from an incident from spreading further, now you can extend that to all 28. Not that it's already working like that, but it is getting there. So this was an amazing change brought by this directive. With that as basis and seeing the willingness of member states to work together, our president asked us to go further. So we decided to propose a cybersecurity act, and this is where the added value of people like myself came because I have been involved in the legislative process in the European Union for over 20 years. Mm-hmm. And this is one thing I know how to do, mm-hmm. how to create laws and negotiate. Mm-hmm. So with a team of experts that we have here who understand cybersecurity very well, we propose the Cybersecurity Act, first of all, to settle the mandate and what this European Cybersecurity Agency must do. This mm-hmm. is known with the acronym ENISA, mm-hmm. is the European Network and Information Systems Agency. It is actually, well, that's accidental. It was a coincidence based in Greece mm-hmm. because these independent agencies of the European Union are scattered across all European countries. Mm. So we decided that this should be rendered a permanent mandate. So mm-hmm. this should be an agency that the European Union should be able to count on permanently.
Yep.
And we also defined better its mandate to go beyond what it is doing now to also serve other purposes. For instance, when it comes to operational support, it is true that we have now a directive that says you must have what it takes to deal with a crisis. Mm. But not everybody will always be able to do that. So we have to be able to use the agency for member states that need it to rely on its services in operational cooperation if we have a large-scale incident mm-hmm. going into more than one country.
And sorry, for listeners that are unacquainted with ENISA, what do you mean by services? What do you have a use case, for example, that you could give for something that ENISA would step in and conduct services or operations?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, ENISA has been running for a number of years. The only pan-European, so for all the member states, exercise of cybersecurity, which mm. brings together all the member states' response teams mm-hmm. under an unknown scenario, mm. and they play for a few days to test their resilience and their vulnerabilities.
So it captures the flag.
Exactly. So yep. this is called Cyber Europe.
Yep.
It is something that was created by ENISA and that has become now a best practice.
Yep.
And ENISA can continue to do that, but now it can also apply a blueprint we have created for the European Union to activate itself in case we have a pan-European crisis.
Okay.
So these were duties that they didn't have before.
Yep.
We haven't had this crisis yet.
Yep.
And you never can prepare enough for these things and you never know when they're coming. But
yep.
at least there is this blueprint and ENISA has its role, much like other agencies,
yeah.
much like Europol that deals with cybercrime,
yeah.
much like our diplomatic response service, the external action service of the Commission, because you also need that.
Yep.
So at least though it has found its place in that ecosystem.
Okay.
Another example of a very important task that ENISA has taken is the second part of our Cybersecurity Act. So we have created perhaps the only regulated, even though voluntary, certification framework in the world mm-hmm. for ICT products and services.
Okay.
The European internal market, as we call it, so the market of the 28 member states, is highly regulated.
Yep.
We're very different from other parts of the world, like the United States, for instance, where mm-hmm. there's more of a market-based approach. Here we take the market base as our evidence, if you yeah. like, for creating regulation. So what we did is we decided that if we want products in the European Union to be safe when they circulate in the market, we also want them to be secure.
Mm-hmm.
But it would have been very difficult to regulate all connected products and services.
Mm-hmm.
So we proposed a voluntary framework that will generate schemes that will certify those areas where we feel this is necessary in the market.
Which areas are those?
So these will have to be decided by all of us together.
Okay.
So the member states will sit together every year with us and draw a plan that we will then also discuss with the market. So we will set up also stakeholders group that mm-hmm. will advise us,
mm-hmm.
both as Commission, but also the whole system, the member states, etc. So we'll create the program, and then we will decide what do we do, where do we start,
mm-hmm.
and ENISA will prepare these schemes that then become basically certificates, which if you issue in one country,
mm.
if you're a manufacturer and you have this certificate that shows you have tested your product,
mm.
it meets high levels of assurance, etc., then it applies to the whole internal market, so all the member states of the European Union. So for the market, it is very interesting mm. because we don't have such a system. First of all, because it gives you an opportunity to have something that is enforceable,
mm.
because now that it is regulated, authorities have to make sure that they enforce it and they have to supervise the market. And that applies to the whole of the EU. So it's very interesting for companies
mm.
because they don't have to go and certify, because there are certification systems now, but they are national
mm.
and they're very expensive.
Mm.
So you pay once. And it applies everywhere.
Now, let's unravel that a bit further and delve into supply chain, because that is a toughie. For example, you're mentioning, say, a manufacturing plant in company X within the market, and it gains this certification. What about the supply chain and the considerations of having a global supply chain within that product? Would it still be, you know, some products would be almost impossible to certify based on the necessities of materials, the necessities of even labor and time spent developing a product in other countries, because that all can impact supply chain.
You're absolutely right. That's why it is difficult to certify product by product. Mm. Also because some products can become obsolete very fast.
Yeah.
How do you define a product if it's changed completely through an update, for instance? Mm. Here we're talking about schemes that will allow certification that meets certain baseline requirements.
Okay. Yep.
So it's something that can last at least as long as the life cycle of the product. And
yeah.
This is how we have defined also the length of the certificates. So the other important thing is that this is not just about products. It's about services. It's about processes. So as to allow as many aspects of the market to be covered.
Mm.
So it's a very flexible system. If it works, it can serve the market very well. But you're very right. It's a global market. So how do you do it? You cannot have norms in Europe that are different from other parts of the world. So the good thing with having done this as a first in Europe is that now it has attracted the interest of other parts of the world where there are existing standards. So we can create schemes with existing international standards that can then become global.
Mm. And then put pressure on maybe more manufacturing intense countries where the incentive to push some of these policies on the manufacturing plants aren't so much now, but they may.
That's absolutely right. And these companies want the opportunity to demonstrate that they are reliable.
Mm.
So this certification will give them a competitive opportunity.
Yep.
So we have a lot of interest from the United States, from Japan. There is even now a request from the G7 that we work together on this certification.
Yep.
So the leadership that Europe showed in this area is creating a global market eventually.
Yeah.
So I think it is really an opportunity for companies. It is really an opportunity also for the smaller companies, because as I mentioned, it will be easier, more accessible, cheaper to get a certificate. When it comes, for instance, to the Internet of Things, if we manage to define well the scope, and for instance there, and ISA has done already some work to define the markets of the Internet of Things because it's vast, we could create a situation by which we generate trust, because now, together with the beauty of the Internet of Things that enters people's life, also issues of trust start to arise because of data breaches, because of the issues of consent. So there is a lot of realization now in the society as to the risks that come also with being connected at all levels. So if we manage to use certification to reassure and also to bring products that are tested in the market, it is also about that, we will achieve a lot. You asked me about my background. The reason why I'm very confident about this is that I used to be responsible for product safety in the European Union. And there we have a full-blown regulated system by which not only do we regulate individual products, so we have regulations for the safety of anything from cars to toys. Exactly.
Yep.
And then on top of that, we have a general law in Europe that says if you're going to place something in the market of the members of the EU, it has to be safe. It's like a safety net.
Yep.
And how do we ensure that? We have a market surveillance system, and we even have a rapid alert system that we inform as soon as something is found in the market that's not conform. Everybody in the European Union is informed so that you have recalls.
Okay.
So when you see in the newspaper recalls of anything from cars to toys because of chemicals, you know, that you find in them.
Or even food with listeria.
Absolutely.
Wow. Okay.
We also have that for food and feed, absolutely.
Yeah.
This is because of this full-blown system. So I've worked for many years in this area.
Okay.
And I believe this is a culture we have to bring now in connected products and services. Be that at the level of the end user being a pure consumer.
Yep.
Or at industrial level, because you also have a lot of business-to-business to deal with there. So
yep.
I think that will be very important. And I hope to bring this experience also for the surveillance of the market, which will be a challenge.
Yeah.
Because we have the big problem of lack of skills in the market. And how do you find the people to make sure that everything operates the way it should?
Well, I'm sure we'll get into that. That's probably
Absolutely.
Going to be the last topic area. But I really think that's a good... not so much an analogy, but it's something that you're, I hate to say this phrase, but everyday citizen who doesn't really get what IoT IoT is and the risks associated with it, but they do get what food safety is. And if you have listeria in food, for example, you need to recall all those certain cheeses that were distributed across countries. Or if a microwave is blowing up in houses, you want to recall that model. And if you've already set that up from a physical aspect within these systems, within sort of physical products, if people put their mind on physical products, if you can apply the same thing with hardware that's powered by software, then it makes complete sense. And I think that's a really good thing to convey to citizenry, that it's a similar principle.
I think once we start having certified products, it will be easier to do that because you will have some information on what products are out there on which you can base your surveillance. You have to start somewhere. At the same time, we know there are private operators who run such a system, such alerts.
Yeah.
It will be good if one day we manage to connect the system and this information sharing that private operators are already carrying out to a system that also authorities can reach.
Yeah.
This is a level on which we had not worked until now. And this is where also this NIS directive we spoke about made a big difference, because for the first time, it imposed obligations on operators of big things, we sort of critical infrastructure, but also digital service providers, so those that provide cloud services or web browsers, etc., to report incidents to the authorities.
Okay.
This obligation does not exist. So since last year, when this directive entered into force, they are obliged to do it, and we are obliged to check with member states that, in fact, they collect this information and that when they see that these critical infrastructures don't provide it, they take measures. This will also create this culture of exchange of information that in cybersecurity does not exist.
Mm.
Because we're dealing with security, everybody is very cautious, and that makes sense. So you also have to find ways of how you exchange this information.
Yep.
So I think it will take a bit of time, but we have started building it. Talking about rapid alert systems, for instance, a few weeks ago, we started running from the European Union a rapid alert system for disinformation campaigns in view of the European elections. Who would have thought of that a few years ago? Whoever wants and can put in this system something that they see running, because we now have experience. We know that disinformation campaigns become massive.
That they exist and they proliferate.
And they're massive. Before a big exercise like European elections in 28 different countries, you can imagine. So I think if we created this system, we can go even further, because if you can do it in a political area such as disinformation, I'm sure we can manage to do it more generally.
So let's, before we jump into the last section again, which is, I guess, about pipeline, about the about developing the next generation of cyber professionals and cyber policymakers. Let's expand on these threats and the risks that we keep on talking about. Who are they? So if we break it down, I mean, you just mentioned disinformation campaigns, but there are also cyber criminals. Can you give me a broad stroke sense of what you guys look at in terms of, let's say, for example, building policy? Are you building policy so that, you know, your black hat hacker over in, or black hat cyber criminal who's hacking over in country X, well, how that differentiates from, say, a nation state actor who's trying to play the big game and manipulate elections?
Well, our policy actions aim at building resilience for all levels of possible attacks, because it's a moving target anyway.
Yeah,
it's not something stable. So they evolve probably faster than our resilience, the attacks.
Yep.
So the idea is that you have a system that can be resilient, that can defend itself, and where we work together to inform each other so that we change best practices so we prevent the spread of attacks.
Yep.
So this is the core of European policy.
Yep.
Then every member state also has its own security policies, national security policies, and the way they deal with these issues.
Mm.
But we also offer to member states the European landscape on threats. This is what actually our agency does, and NISA does that very well. They've been doing this for a year. They have an annual threat landscape report. That report, for instance, for last year shows that we more or less are on the same threats. So we continue to have mail and phishing or crypto miners, etc. But it also shows an increase in state-sponsored agents attacking our systems.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, there, attribution is a very political issue.
Mm.
But for that reason, we have also created a diplomatic toolbox in the European Union, which allows the diplomats of our member states to mm-hmm. work together to develop joint responses, to exchange information that they have, mm-hmm. to make joint political statements, to make joint diplomatic advances to relevant countries mm-hmm. Should there be a problem. But also recently, we even adopted rules on restrictive measures to take mm-hmm. in case of cyber attacks. Mm-hmm. So this toolbox is really now becoming very substantive. And again, the joint response approach is becoming stronger and stronger. So we are employing what we know how to do best in the European Union, which is working together mm-hmm. in cybersecurity, also at the diplomatic level. Mm. And this toolbox even includes tougher approaches like diplomatic pressure, mm-hmm. etc. We have in place a system. Mm. So far, we didn't have to use it. Because on individual issues with countries that may come up, also we try to take the constructive approach of our usual dialogues in the area of trade or in the multilateral fora, etc. So we have in mind this new developing threat. Mm-hmm. So we're developing also separate measures for that. And then you also have in the recent landscape report of ENISA, other new threats like disinformation, mm-hmm. which is not a typical threat like malware, but you can use security breaches also for disinformation. Mm-hmm. And you can also use security to fight disinformation by seeking the identity, for instance, of those that are behind it, etc. So security can also help you fight disinformation no matter what its origin mm-hmm. is. So this is included now in our radar. And again, on that, we take extra action. For instance, two weeks ago here in the European Parliament, we held for the first time a tabletop exercise with all the authorities of the member states that run the elections together with their emergency response teams mm-hmm. in view of the European elections. Mm-hmm. So we sat together, we had an exercise, and we tested how do we deal with cyber attacks of our systems, yeah. be that typical cyber attacks that attack the electronic systems that run the elections, because as they are cross-border, they are immense electronic systems that are involved, but also issues like disinformation that can run through social media across the European Union.
And this tabletop exercise was less sort of technical, but more a what-if type of scenario, policy, decision, operational, kind of cyber range without the hardcore tech.
A typical exercise that we could run in the short time that we had since the Commission decided to assist member states at their request in this respect.
Yep.
And this is an evolution.
Yeah.
Who would have thought a few years ago that member states would want to work on such a sensitive topic together?
Yeah.
Because, as you know, you protect areas like your electoral system at national level.
At national level,
there's
exactly.
a lot of intelligence that comes with it.
Yeah.
So you had national intelligence services that in some countries, in fact, are the emergency response teams that were sitting in a room talking to each other, getting to know each other.
Mm.
And I believe this is also the strength of Europe, and this is what will help us also become more resilient.
Mm. And yet much more complicated as well. There's a lot of great initiatives happening. One last question on this.
But on the threats, I wanted to say one more thing.
Mm.
So there are also threats that come from the new technologies.
Yep.
We were talking earlier off the record about areas like artificial intelligence, etc.
Yeah.
So I think this is the next step. The next step is to see how we deal with the new technologies that come in that may not necessarily pose threats, that pose challenges of security.
Mm.
A few weeks ago, we adopted the recommendation for the security of 5G networks.
Mm-hmm.
Because in Europe, we have a very, very big action plan, and we invest a lot for the rollout of 5G technologies mm-hmm. because we believe they can bring capacity that is necessary to unroll all this big digital transformation that we want for our society in areas like health, mm-hmm. in areas like electronic governments, so digitizing public administration, applications like connected cars mm-hmm. and smart cities. So you need really the capacity of 5G.
Mm.
And we need to top that ambition with relevant ambition in security.
Mm-hmm.
So because of discussions that have taken place recently regarding the fact that this is a market that is quite limited in terms of who can provide 5G services,
mm-hmm.
we issued a recommendation about how member states can step up their resilience and how to take security measures in a coordinated way across Europe. And again, it was the governments in a recent summit of the heads of state that took place in March that asked us to do so. They said, we want a coordinated approach. We don't want every member state to start doing their own thing because of our systems being connected and because we take this harmonized approach.
What was the recommendation?
So the recommendation is to take, first of all, we're going to do a risk assessment to see what the problems can be. But then the recommendation is that member states should make sure that they require security components when they make public procurements in this area. For instance, bring in certification, if we have certification schemes that can cover 5G networks, to make them mandatory in their countries. So a number of a toolbox, again, that we will propose by the end of the year. This is what we have agreed after we have done the risk assessment, so that member states have the same tools to fight it, without, of course, prejudging what they can do at national level, where they can go even further. But the idea was to have a coordinated approach, so again, you don't have countries where everything is switches off, and others
or
not.
You're doubling up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you see, this is, again, in the threat landscape, there are many things you need to consider. We are bringing artificial intelligence a lot in our work now, also on security. We see that companies use artificial intelligence for protection measures. But of course, artificial intelligence is now becoming a tool for spreading also risks and for attacking. So this we need to start factoring in, and that we intend to do also by investing more in research in this area.
It's fascinating, isn't it? If you go back 2,000 years and someone had a spear and then you build a bow and arrow and then arms and the development of arms on each side, it's a never-ending story. And I think that's, you know, if you take a Stoic philosophical approach, that's just life, right?
As a Greek, I should be able to take a philosophic approach.
Yeah, right.
But as a security person, I have learned that it's all about hard facts and making sure you cover all angles.
Oh, 1,000%. And yet when you cover all angles, undoubtedly within, you know, X months or years' time, you will find that you didn't cover all angles. My point is, you know, you've got to, you know, you choose your side and you focus on developing and researching the best you can, and then you plug the gaps when you find out that you didn't actually do the best you could, or within a couple of years' time, there's new technology which opens up different weaknesses. So it's interesting with countries looking to mitigate risk from vendor suppliers. England is an example of them mixing a certain product's kit and putting it in within a testing lab with their National Cybersecurity Centre. So the guys were very, very well armed in identifying different weaknesses and vulnerabilities in technology. The complexity is the rate of change and the pace of development that some of this tech has means that any advisory of weaknesses found and patches needed creates a backlog, so much so that it's the debate in some circles is whether it's effectual or not, and that's the double-edged sword of the you know, the rate of change and development in technology. But that's something you can mitigate as much risk for as possible. It's always going to be there, and we're always going to have to combat that in some way. And that's, you know, that comes with regulation, smart directives, and policies. So, all right, let's get into Women for Cyber. So. Tell me about this new initiative. You're one of the co-founders, I believe. Founder?
Well, we have a number of us who are founding members.
Okay, so, yes, founding member.
Definitely one of them, but not the only, and there are many, actually. So what is this about? First of all, let me give you the background of how this started. This started from the European Cybersecurity Association. This is an association that was created with a bit of a push from the European Commission.
EXO, isn't it?
Exactly. That's called EXO. And you know, because
I spoke
you work
on a
with
panel.
EXO. So you know that we encouraged the industry to create this association.
Yep.
Because again, there was a fragmentation in how they were federated in the area of cybersecurity. And we did that because a few years ago, we signed a public-private contract between the European Commission and the industry to develop research and innovation. So we invested 450 million euro in the research for a number of years. And the industry committed to invest three times the same on a common agenda that would address exactly what you were talking about earlier. So where are the areas where we need to invest because we don't know what's happening and we need market solutions? We will see how far we have gone with this contract because it finishes in 2021. But part of this contract and part of the areas where EXO as well identified we have problems is skills.
Mm.
And as part of bringing more skills in Europe, we also felt, well, let's also bring some more women. The problem with skills is that we are short of skills across the world.
Mm.
We are missing, in the next 5 years, I think our estimate is about 350,000 people. And I understand it's exactly the same in the United States.
Yeah, or more. Some estimates I've heard are up to 1 million.
Exactly. Yeah. If you couple that with the fact that you have a very low percentage of women represented in cybersecurity, for Europe it's 11%.
Mm.
I think the global figure, a recent study showed that 20%, that's a bit better at global level. It was important to bring the two together and to see how we bring more the narrative of more women in tech and in studying STEM, actually, which is part of our bigger policy in the European Commission, to bring it in for cyber. And we found that there were a lot of competent women who wanted to talk about that, who also represented exactly the issue of the how multidisciplinary cybersecurity is.
Mm.
Because we have understood, and we see that from studies, that a lot of women or other people do not enter cybersecurity thinking that it is for specialists that have studied just that.
Mm.
This is a myth from many perspectives, first of all, because it is not necessary to have studied. There is no security studies.
Mm.
It is not necessary to have studied something relevant. You can always learn the skills if you've studied technology, or if you're an engineer, or if you've studied mathematics, etc.
Or if you've got YouTube and a pen and paper.
Exactly. And so the willingness and the passion, you're absolutely right. And some people also have natural talent that does not necessarily come with university studies, but practice, as you rightly said. So if you combine that, and if you also see that even if you have studied ICT, you studied ICT even 10 years ago, it's not the same today as it was back then.
Yeah.
So if you combine these two factors, you have to create a narrative of how everybody has something to contribute, so long as you said, they have the passion and the willingness.
Mm.
Plus, you need different specializations. For instance, when it comes to cybercrime, you need anything from enforcement people to psychologists, so to understand also how the cyber criminals operate.
Mm.
Then you need the lawyers like myself that can design the relevant legal framework. And of course, you need the specialists. And this is where we're lacking the skills. So we brought together women from all these walks of life.
Mm.
So there were anything from mayors of places where they have gone smart and they want to make sure they do that in a secure way. So they're very keen on bringing in the security culture, to diplomats who have negotiated difficult situations in the diplomatic world.
Mm.
Then specialists, academics, researchers, policymakers, but even managers of companies that work in technology and security. So this group of women sat together and put together a number of ideas of how we can bring women closer to cybersecurity and how we can encourage young women to enter this world, so that we fill the skills gap also in an area where not only will they find jobs, but it is also very human-centric and serves a bigger purpose, whether you work in the private or the public world.
Mm-hmm.
So this is how Women for Cyber started. It started as an initiative of EXO together with the European Commission. In fact, it was our commissioner, who happens also to be a woman and to have a very strong women's agenda, Mrs. Maria Gabriel, who launched it. And our objective is to try and, first of all, create a set of good practice examples that people can borrow and apply to their companies or in the public sector. How do you attract more people?
For example?
For example, there are some authorities that lack people in the area of cybersecurity, so they take students who are at university, they give them the opportunity of traineeships, they pay for their studies with a commitment that they will work for a number of years with them.
Authorities
for instance, in the Netherlands, they have an approach of this kind. Then there are private companies that, again, provide opportunities either for training or for young apprenticeships for women who want to enter this world. We have some telecommunication companies who do that, because this is the area where they really cannot find specialists.
It's what some of the large consulting companies have been doing for years, like the Accentures of the world and the big, you know, the big four.
But to do that in areas like, for instance, telecommunications can be extremely useful.
Yeah, yeah.
So because you create already a power force there. So these are the kind of practices we would like to put together and create like a compendium, if you like, that people can start applying, that can bring more people in the area of cybersecurity. So this is part of our skills agenda, but also part of our more women in tech, again, because there is this inherent fear that technology is more of a male profession. And I fear that when I entered myself the area of cybersecurity, I became witness of that. And I still do not understand why, because I do not think that there is anything that should prevent a woman from entering the world. It's just that there's a lot of ignorance. And this is the other level. We have a lot of interesting people who have written books about the importance of women in cybersecurity and how they bring a cyber perspective that is different in the area of security, that have joined the initiative and that we will now make ambassadors who will go around the world and talk about it. But also create a workforce of women who understand cybersecurity. We have some extraordinary professors of crypto or other special areas of cybersecurity that can become ambassadors of actually teaching it. And we have proposed actually as European Commission to make a list of European women who are specialists, who can become then available to speak from anything that, like conferences or to give lectures at universities and become also role models like that, because some are extraordinary people.
This needs to happen. And there's a very interesting thing that I was listening to yesterday on DDC. I can't remember the article, but it was talking about this. It was talking about STEM. And I'll have to dig it up from BBC's programming yesterday, but effectively they had two women speakers on. One was focused on AI, one was focused on cyber, both are keynote speakers. And one of them was mentioning the annoying double-edged of being a keynote speaker and a woman, because she almost felt tokenized. But the necessity of her going out there and continuing with the keynote speakers is evident, because it is inspiring more women and girls to get into the industry, even though it is she felt that it was tokenized. Obviously, if she's the best person in the room, then it's justified that she felt that, and yet it's a horrible thing that she had to contend with.
But that's exactly the point. This is why we propose to create this list of people that will also demonstrate their expertise, because it's true.
Exactly.
If you're invited just because you're a woman, of course you feel
tokenized.
Absolutely. And I do not like to be invited because I'm a woman. I want to be invited because
you're
I have
best.
Something relevant to say.
Yeah.
It is not just about being the best. You need to be relevant in the context. So if you invite me in a panel about very specific technological operational issues, I am absolutely certain there are people who are much better than me. I can talk to you about how we make the policy. So it is all about also having the relevant people. So this is why we came up with this proposal. And the reason why we need that is because it's not just about gender streaming, which of course is the bigger purpose. But we know that companies or authorities, organizations in general, who have this balance are more successful. Because you need
both in terms of, you know,
diversity,
profit gain,
absolutely,
and everything.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think everybody has to gain. But that's why we hope that we will create a little bit of a stream, and also give the opportunity to women who are specialists to expose themselves and to say more about what they know and to become role models for the younger, be that men or women. It's talking about cybersecurity that matters.
Well, on that note, we can leave it there. And Despina, you yourself are an inspiration. I think you're doing a wonderful job and in a very, very complicated landscape. So just to finish off, where can people find you to follow any updates? Are you on Twitter? Do you have any
I'm on Twitter under my name, Despina Spanu. I'm on LinkedIn as well for professionals. I post every now and then on LinkedIn relevant topics. I think this is how we got connected. So, and of course, we have the website of the European Commission where you can find all our priorities and all our actions.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity, and the European Commission.
The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy, because being human is the common denominator for us all. The project is supported by iZoom Technology Consulting, a global company specializing in cybersecurity, technological innovation for clients in defense and the private sector, and it's hosted on the Agenda Digitale website, an online news source reporting breaking news in tech and associated policy.